the United States, 1 in 50 adults has obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. It's the fourth most common mental disorder, diagnosed nearly as often as asthma and diabetes mellitus. During the Middle Ages, it was believed that people who experienced obsessive thoughts were possessed by the devil, which may be a reason that even nowadays most people with OCD do everything they can to hide their condition. And that's particularly difficult if you're someone in the public eye and you're expected to hug everybody and never lose focus. It may be one of the reasons Howie Mandel has tried to hide his struggles with OCD over the years, but now the comedian, actor, and game show host has written a memoir about how that struggle has shaped his life and career. He's called it Here's the Deal, Don't Touch Me, and it's published by Bantam Books, and he joins me now on our show, and I promise not to try to shake his hand or force him to open the door by himself. Welcome to our show.
What a gracious host. Thank you so much.
You say that you also have ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
Yes.
And I wondered...
A litany of...
you have some other things. You recently had a heart condition. Yeah. Do ADHD and OCD often occur together?
I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that it is frequent that there are, that there is some relation, but I don't know. You know, I don't know that for fact. But in my life, It has always been together. You know, I didn't really write a book about OCD or ADHD. I wrote a book.
We'll talk about your story.
Pardon me?
We'll talk about your story.
No, but I'm answering your question. Yeah. I wrote a book about myself. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was just going to be a funny autobiography. What I ended up realizing was that, you know, myself and what encompasses and informs everything I do and every decision I make and every move I make and every waking minute of my life is the OCD and ADHD.
And there is disagreement in the medical community as to whether OCD is more psychological or biological, but you seem to be suggesting here in telling your story that there's a genetic component in your case because your grandmother was a germaphobe.
Well, no, I don't know whether there is.
Well, you say she practically polished the walk in front of her house.
Right, but the obsessive compulsive disorder is, I believe, a physiological disorder where you have repetitive thoughts or you have repetitive obsessions for rituals. And so regardless of, you know, whether it's germs or whether it's tapping something three times to the right and then these thoughts are, I think, even though they're irregular thoughts or they make no sense intellectually, I think they pop up in everybody's head. But the difference between somebody with OCD and not is the fact that that loop continues and you can't get past it unless without that compulsion to take care of it. For me, it's washing hands. So in answer to
your
question...
Some people are checking the door to make sure it's locked.
I have that also. But the point is the fact that my... mom and her mother were obsessively clean, that may have triggered that thought, but it has nothing to do with the OCD. You know, it has OCD is the fact of whether I have an obtrusive dark thought or, you know, somebody shook my hand and I can't get the thought that there's a germ on my hand and I obsessively continually wash my hands is about the OCD and not the fact that my mother was clean. But if I did pick up the act of cleanliness and that happens to be a big trigger, then I'm luckier than the person who picked up the need to spin around counterclockwise three times every time they go through a doorway.
Or the person who thinks that going outside is going to kill them because there are germs out there and they're going to breathe them. But you can come across as seeming a bit paranoid, and I wonder how you got through life because you are in a...
Well, I didn't get through it. I'm getting through it.
Yeah, but I mean, you're in a glad-handing profession where you got to shake people's hands. Or
I
you
don't. Gotta,
well, you don't, but most people do. They air kiss. They do all sorts of stuff that's just automatic. 98% of the guests who come here who know me, that we wind up touching each other in some way.
Really?
Well, in a friendly kind of...
But the truth is...
Air-kissy way.
You touch and air kiss people? I don't, that's my personal issue that I deal with each and every day. That's one. That's such a small component of what I deal with, but I'm dealing with it every day. You know, I'm in, very deep therapy as we speak, and I see people and I'm medicated and I will do whatever it takes to cope with whatever issues I have.
There are certain kinds of therapies that are available. The exposure and response prevention mm-hmm. approach. Mm-hmm. And that's usually they just simply force you to confront your problems and you survive and that's the end of that.
Yeah, what I say, you know, people will ask me what I do and I don't really talk about specifically what the remedies are. And there are, you know, and you can cope through it. The fear that I have about talking about specific, you know, remedies and specific types of therapy and medication is the fact that, as you said, 1 in 40 people suffer from this. I don't want a listener to say, oh, you know what, Howie Mandel, and I do, I'm doing fine. I'm out there. I have a good career. I have a great relationship. Howie Mandel does this. I'm going to do this. What works for one may not work for another. And even what works for me may not work for me 2 months from now. I'm always changing up whatever it is that I'm doing just to find tools to move on.
When did this start?
I can't remember.
Because you describe yourself in this book as someone the other kids in elementary school saw as a weirdo. Do you think it was because of this or was it because of other things?
This lent itself to creating a weirdness and an oddness about me, you know, from being a little boy who wouldn't retie his shoe once the lace touched the ground because I was afraid of the dirt and the germs I would get from that. So I was ridiculed for not being able to tie my shoes.
And shuffling along.
And I would shuffle along and not lift my foot so I wouldn't lose my shoe. And I was walking from place to place like Quasimodo. And my ADD was such that, you know, I couldn't focus. I knew I had to go to the restroom, and then on my way to the restroom, something shiny or a noise would take my focus, and then I'd be focused on that, and I would end up, you know, wetting myself. So, like, there I was. I had, you know, wet myself, and my shoe was falling off, and I was just this little mess that...
And the girls would say, titch, titch, when they saw you and roll their eyes.
Girls didn't really say anything to me. That was more about later on when I tried to be funny. You know, I found a way into... I understood that comedy was, my parents were very much into comedy. They bought albums, they watched comedies on television, and I would hear laughter, and I knew that was a good thing, but I didn't really, if I was in the room, I didn't really understand the essence of what they were listening to and causing that laughter. So one day I watched Alan Funt, I watched with them, I watched Candid Camera, and I saw that, and that kind of clicked for me, but I didn't really understand what clicked for me. I thought that if you do a joke on someone, and I didn't know what a joke was, but the fact that I knew I was kidding, even if nobody else knew, I thought that was the joke.
So some of these jokes are rather lame initially.
No, it was just, there was no joke. There was no audience. There was no joke. The fact is that you didn't know that I was just kidding. So therefore, and that's the kind of thing that girls, boys, I was like a pariah, would just roll their eyes and think I was just insane.
Now, so many of the funniest people in this country come from Canada. As
right.
you do, you're
right.
in Toronto. Do you think that there is a Canadian thing? Why do so many really hilarious people?
I think we have a good exchange rate. I have no idea.
Were you afraid when the Canadian dollar suddenly was stronger than the U.S. dollar that everything would fall apart?
You know, for me, and I'm not analytical at all, and I never analyzed, and I never, you know, I chronicle this in my book. I never intended on being in show business or being a comedian. It just happened.
You didn't go to college.
I did. I don't have a GED.
Yes, you never graduated high school.
I did not.
And you were a carpet salesman. You were selling carpet remnants.
Yes.
Before you ever even thought about show business, and now you're completely bald. You don't even wear a rug.
You got me. You're a nut. Yes, that's absolutely true.
I was a class clown too. Unfortunately,
were you? I see where it led.
Yeah, I know where it led.
And now you're
many
a
years of therapy.
Do you do that too?
I'm such
a proponent. You did? You would never do it again? I don't think there's anybody alive.
I'm healthy now. I'm perfect.
I don't think anybody is. And I think that, you know, we take care of our dental health. We don't take care of our mental health. And there is a stigma, huge stigma, attached to this issue. And
you were still living with your parents at the age of 22.
Yes. You're really extolling all my virtues. It's very positive. You know, thank God I'm married. This is not a great...
Yeah, well, it sounds like your wife, Terry, is incredibly tolerant.
Incredibly tolerant and loving and supportive and really deserves a... when you read this book, I should be so lucky to have, you know, somebody go out and buy it and read it. I would imagine if you were ever introduced to my wife, you'll just want to hug her and say, I'm so sorry.
My guess, so sorry. Howie Mandel, who's... written a book called Here's the Deal, Don't Touch Me. It's published by Bantam. So you said that you got into it accidentally. You went to a comedy club called Yuck Yucks?
Yes, it was in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, and 77 was it was the week before that. There was a comedy boom that was starting. You know, disco was kind of dying out, and comedy was becoming very trendy. It was the new disco, all the new young Chico and the Man had begun with Freddie Prinze, you know, and we were aware that, you know, he was discovered at the Comedy Store, and New York had Catch a Rising Star was starting out. Rick Newman's Catch a Rising Star. We'd see a comic and then a musician, Pat Benatar, and then a comic, and George Carlin had really exploded onto the scene with his new look, was as the hippie, you know.
And then Robin Williams.
He came out of San Francisco, and he got Mork and Mindy, and so this was this explosion. And I went to a comedy club. I'd never seen this form of entertainment before, and it was exciting, and it was electric, and it was new, and it was edgy, and it was live, and you were there, and it was exciting. And they said at the end of the show, the host said, we also have an amateur night on Monday nights. If you think you can do this, you know, you're invited after midnight to come up and do this. And all the people at my table turned to me and said, you should do it. And I, why not? And not because I would be a comedian, but it'd just be a fun little lark. And I did it.
But then you have to write an act. To figure out what you're going to do.
Yeah, that I didn't think about that.
So you just went up and...
If you have tapes, and it's available on YouTube, and you know, a lot of my act, and even today, it was the nervous... Now I have, after, you know, 30-some-odd years and you know, 50-some-odd years in life, I have enough to draw on and enough material. But I'm very improvisational and in the moment and very honest. And I was very nervous and scared getting up there. But a very kind of nice nervous and scared, the kind you get if you enjoy the thrill of a roller coaster. You know, and this was my living roller coaster. And I was in the moment. And I kind of showed it. And it was very external. You know, I had a lot of energy and exuberance. And I was giggling out of nervousness. And the audience would giggle with me. And I'd look at them and not really understand what they were laughing at. And I'd go, what? What? And that became like a catchphrase. And then, you know, I was doing things like I didn't know what to do. And I was carrying my rubber gloves because I wouldn't touch things because of my germophobic ways. And I took out the glove and I didn't have anything to do. And for whatever reason, I can't explain it to myself, I pulled it over my head and I started breathing with my nose and the fingers would go up and down. And I became known as the guy with the rubber glove who would pop that. You know,
you have to stop doing that when it actually caused you health problems.
I perforated a sinus. I'm probably the only guy in America with a note.
You put a glove over your head more recently, but you can do this once in a blue moon, right?
I don't know what the prescription is, but yes, I did it on Earl for the television show, but I don't do it frequently. But
how did you stay focused? Because people with OCD have all these extraneous thoughts that they, as you said earlier, that they can't get rid of. Did they not come to you while you were on stage?
No. In fact, at the stage for me, and to this day, is the happiest, most comfortable place I could possibly be. Quiet is a nightmare for me. And, solace is a nightmare for me because that's when they come. If I live in the now, if I can distract myself, and performing without much of a plan allows me this and gives me that energy, I seem to be free of my demons. And it's great you talked about the history of it where they thought they were possessed by the devil. There is no better way to describe it because it's like my mind is taken over.
You aware that these are irrational thoughts?
Absolutely, which is more painful because, you know, intellectually I understand it's irrational. Intellectually I understand that I have checked the door. So why am I going back the seventh time? How come I can't convince my mind to stop my body from going back the ninth time, the 30th time? How come I know that I'm now a half an hour late for my appointment and I'm still shaking the door? And then I'll take my fist and I'll smash it into the door so that I can feel the pain, because maybe the pain will tell my mind, I've checked it so much I have a throbbing pain in my fist. I can't stop my compulsions.
How long did you work at the Yuck Yuck or Yuck Yucks before you got paid for doing this?
A few months I drop in, and for me it was never, once I started dropping in and I was there every single night, it was not a career. It was a great, you know, like a guy.
You're still selling carpet.
Yeah, but in no way did I think, oh, great, now I'm a comedian. I thought this was a great club that I'd go at night the same way some guys in town would have a pickup basketball game at night. I didn't play squash. I didn't play basketball. I didn't go dancing. So I went there, and then they offered me to be the featured act, and they paid me $150, and I did 9 shows, Monday through Friday, 2 on Friday, 2 on Saturday, 1 on Sunday, or 3
on Sunday. That's below minimum wage. You didn't become a professional until you did the same sort of thing at the Comedy Store, where you went up and did an act.
And there was a producer in the audience from a comedy game show called Make Me Laugh. And he hired me right there on the spot. It was a great story to tell about my vacation. And I went and did that and then flew back to Toronto, continued in business. And people started seeing me on TV. Dick Shawn called me up. Do you remember Dick Shawn?
Of course. He was the greatest improviser.
Amazing. He was a great improviser, a great comedian. He had a great act. He actually died on stage with his son doing the lights in San Diego. He called me up, and I was a huge fan. I couldn't believe it. And he was doing a pilot at NBC and flew me down to do that. I did that, and then I got seen by Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas.
How did you wind up acting? I mean, many people will remember you from St. Elsewhere, but you've been in a bunch of films,
also,
a lot of TV.
Also luck.
Did you take lessons?
No, I'll tell you that story. I didn't take any lessons, but I was thriving as a comic. I had gotten an HBO special, and in those days, you know, just being on TV, it changed my life forever. I was selling out shows. I was playing here at Radio City Music Hall, the next step would have been to do a sitcom like you talked about, Mork and Mindy and all these. Billy Crystal was on Soap. So I went and had a general meeting at MTM, which was a production company owned by Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker. And they were launching a couple of dramas. One was Hill Street Blues, and another one was St. Elsewhere. And they had been doing this pilot for 4 days. They shut down the pilot, and it wasn't going well, and they did some recasting. I didn't know. I went in for a general meeting with a lady by the name of Molly Lapata, and she said, you know, can you act? I said, I don't know. She said, read this. And I read these sides, which was all this mumbo-jumbo, medical jargon. And she said, very good. I didn't even know what I had said. Come down the hall. And I went down the hall, and I met with who I now know is Mark Tinker and Bruce Paltrow and Tom Fontana and Falsey and Brand, who created the show. And I was reading the same thing again. Halfway through, they went, that's fine. And I stopped.
You became
and I went
Dr. Wayne Fiskus.
The next day.
Well, I know that we've pretty much run out of time.
Okay.
And I know that I can strike fear into you by simply saying the words Howard. Whether it's Howard Hughes
never
or Howard Stern, even though your name is Howard, but we won't go into that.
Right.
But I really do want to thank you for coming by to talk about the book. It's called Here's the Deal, Don't Touch Me. It is published by Bantam, and it's been a real pleasure. And as you noticed, I didn't even try to come close.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I know. Can you imagine that my book came out in the midst of a pandemic of H1N1? I have book signings. You have no idea how much medication I'm on right now, and I'm so nervous. But buy the book. There's no reason to come and see me.
Or to give them the flu.
Yes.